This podcast of Snap Judgment is supported by MailChimp. More than 3 million people and businesses use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com. Okay, so you might not know this about me, Snappers, but I come from a long line of people who know how to throw down in the kitchen, right? My great-grandmother's cornbread, my grandmother's sweet potato pie, my Uncle Eddie Lee's black-eyed peas, his ham hocks, his greens. I'm blessed with all this legacy, so you better get out of my way come holiday celebration times, right? Yes, I'm cooking the bird. Yes, I'm cooking the prime rib. We're in California now? Okay. I'll cook the Dungeness crab. That's how I show love to my family. I can't say it. I'd feel awkward and strange and ridiculous, but I can say, let me fix you a plate. So imagine my dismay when my father comes to my house for the holidays holding this bag.
Hey, look here. I got this at the Safeway. It's a fully cooked turkey with all the trimmings. This way, no one has to slave over a hot stove.
It took me a minute, Snappers. It took me a hot minute not to lose my mind and go all Detroit up on my father, but I said, Pops, you can take that little bag back to the car, use it for sandwiches, give it to the homeless, but corporations are not cooking our holiday meal. I'm going to show you some love, Father. I'm going to show you some gratitude today at the dinner table and today on Snap Judgment. From PRX and NPR, that's what I want to give to you as well. It's the Snap Judgment Gratitude Special. Amazing stories we're thankful for. Stories of food and wine in the most unlikely of circumstances. Grab a plate. Have something to drink. Everything is made with love. The Lions are going to beat the Cowboys this year. I guarantee it. Because you're listening. Snap judgment. Now, we're going to start off today's episode with a bang. Mike Ramsdell is one of those guys that people make movies about. He's a covert operative with the goal of extracting a very high-level target.
I really do think I had a death wish. I was just going through some very, very difficult times. And so when State contacted me and asked me to consider this mission, I just thought, you know, bring it on. I'm your man. Bring it on. No matter what happens, I can live with it. If I make it back, that's fine. If I don't, who's going to care? It truly was escapism. I wanted just to get out. It was very important for us to find some informants, and we did find three individuals, what we call in the spy world assets. And these three Russian individuals worked for the target, the man that we were after. But when it was all said and done, just as the mission was to conclude and we were going to extract the target out of the country, one of the informants betrayed us and told the target who we were and what we were about to do. And that's when the mission went bad. My orders were to sanitize the mission. And what that means in spook lingo is to get rid of anything and everything. So if the KGB or the Soviet secret police came into our apartments, they would not be able to find anything. I was instructed, you will not have your weapon, you will not have your communication device. I threw away my weapon and my radio into the river. In the middle of the night, I was definitely on my own. I would have to use all my training and resources to survive. My orders were clean those apartments, do my work, and then get out of town as quick as possible. the last apartment that I was to sterilize was on the sixth floor. There was something that told me to look outside, and I walked across the hallway to the kitchen, pulled back the drapes, I looked down, and there I saw two mafia goons waiting for me. People think that, 007, he never shows his true emotions, but that's not true at all. I knew I was in big trouble because I'd already disposed of my weapon and my communication device. I couldn't confront them. I had nothing, and suddenly I heard the crowbar break the front door of the apartment. The fear and the panic was just, even retelling the story right now, my heart's beating. I heard the crowbar start to break the front door, and all I could do was, I had no other choice. I had to confront them. I pulled on my gloves, I zipped up my jacket, I walked towards the front door and said a prayer, and then the splinters and the door came apart. There, the mafia goon was standing there. I had a maneuver worked out with a certain blow to his temple. I had nothing, and he had a pair of brass knuckles. Within a short time, I looked like a big red wedge of Swiss cheese. Somehow, we ended up in this stairwell. In one hand, he has these bloody brass knuckles. In the other, he pulled out a stiletto knife and was jousting where the first cuts were going to go. Just as he was ready to carve me up, by the grace of God, there was the building drunk on the stairwell underneath us, and he reached up through the stairwell and grabbed the mafia goon's pant leg and pulled on it. And in that saving moment, when that mafia goon looked down, I flew around him and over him. Down those stairs I bounded. I told myself, Mike, get to the train station. I'd lost so much blood from the beating. I stopped by a vacant building and turned around to see how close they were behind me. And the only movement on the street that night was the falling snow, the very first snow of the oncoming Russian winter. Why did I choose to do this? I didn't have to accept this assignment. Headquarters had directed me that I would catch a local train, and I would be on that train for several days until I got to the village of Potevka, where indeed we did have a safe house. I am so thankful to be on the train and to be alive. At the same time, I'm constantly looking over my shoulder, thinking that the mafia or the KGB are on the train with me. I'm in terrible, terrible condition. The only sustenance I had in those 5 days was the awful Russian black tea that was available to everyone on the train. I cannot tell you how hungry and starved I was, but I knew if I could hang on long enough, it is policy that every safe house is equipped with 7 days MREs, meals ready to eat. It was late at night, it was dark, blizzard, snowy. I got to this dilapidated train station. I made my way, trudging through the heavy snow, about a mile to the cabin. I walked to the cupboard, opened the doors. There are no boxes of MREs. Went to the back of the cabin, to the closet, looked in the floorboards, up in the rafters of the cabin, and again, no MREs. I was so spent, I pulled probably a dozen blankets over me and crawled in a straw bed, fully dressed. In the morning, trudged into the village, to the marketplace, and I convinced myself, there, you lucky cuss, you will be able to get some cabbage, whoopee, some potatoes. And strange as it sounds, as I walked, I saw no one. I saw no tracks in the snow. When I finally approached the marketplace and pushed open the big oak doors, and that's when I realized the village had basically been abandoned. I was hoping to see a light on or a candle burning and to find someone, and I did. I was able to talk to two old couples, and I took out a fistful of rubles in exchange for a potato, and they would not do it. The conditions in Russia were awful. I had more rubles than those old couples would ever have seen in their life, and yet keeping food for themselves to survive was more important. That's when the first thoughts came to my mind that, Mike, you might not make it. How am I going to survive? Where is the food going to come from? Get back to the cabin. I was almost obsessed with the idea of dying, and I thought, there I am, isolated in this little village in the middle of Russia, and that's how I was going to die. Why can't it be a gun battle on the streets of Moscow so that the people can read about this hero? I had been in the cabin possibly 3 days. It was mid-morning. Sorry, but I get a little emotional in this part. I'm at a table writing letters of goodbye because I'm not going to make it. And when any one of us writes a letter, the first thing we do is put a date on it. I had totally lost touch with reality and especially date and time. But when I pulled out my calendar, that is the moment when I first realized that it is Thanksgiving in America. I heard this loud thump or bang. I thought it could be an explosive. And that's when I heard the sound of a vehicle. I hustled to the window, but there was so much snow, I could not identify the vehicle, but it sounded like the engine of a Jeep. Knowing about one or two of our agents losing their hands or their face, I panicked, waiting for the explosion to happen. I ran to the back of the cabin, probably waited 15, 20 minutes, and nothing happened. I pulled the cabin door open 6, 8, 10 inches, and there on the stone steps of the cabin was a package about the size of a normal shoebox. There's no turning back now. I grab the package. My heart is pounding, and I pull the string off the package. There, the first thing, a box of macaroni and cheese, a little small box of frosted flakes, a jar of artichoke hearts, and there I see the Thanksgiving card. And I recognized the handwriting of my sister Karen. And then I prepared my Thanksgiving meal. There was a little package. I remember when I fixed the meal around the outside of the plate, I put all these little colorful gummy bears. They had made their way from Torrance, California to the American Embassy in Helsinki, Finland, and somehow from Helsinki, Finland to the safe house in Potevka, Russia. Over the years, I made a concentrated effort to find out how the package could have gotten to Potevka and who brought it there and why. But in our line of work in intelligence, there is a cliche that is called the need to know. And I am not privileged to ask any questions about it because, Mike, do you have a need to know? When you work in the covert world, there are so many unanswered questions you have. I still do not have a definitive answer as to how the package got to me.
That's a pretty good Thanksgiving dinner story, Mike. Thanks so much for sharing with the Snap. Now, Mike wrote a book about this experience. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Goriel. And next up on the Gratitude Special, we're going to keep traveling, this time to Eastern Europe. Snap favorite Jonathan Grobert shares his story.
In April of 1996, I went to Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. The war in Bosnia had only just come to an end, and my wife, Dragana, who is from Bosnia, went to see her family there for the first time in 4 years. And the atmosphere in Belgrade itself was charged. Slobodan Milosevic was still in power, the old Yugoslavia was dead, and war was in the air. And there I was, a tourist in a city on the edge of an abyss. Dragana's two cousins, Sremica and Goca, decided that I should see something of their city. So off we went to what they claimed was the largest Orthodox church in the Balkans. This city had once been rich, but now it was poor, desperate, slightly beaten, and it seemed to me resigned to more beatings. The people looked busy. They went to work. They went to cafes. But they also looked, lost. And there it was, St. Sava. Its heaving domes, not really elegant, just very, very big. And it looked closed. I mean, could we go in? We found an open gate and walked to the little vicarage next to the church. And there was a painfully thin young man of about 25. He was sitting, reading a newspaper, and his white shirt was transparent with sweat. He said his name was Slobo, and Goca and Sremica told Slobo I was a visiting American and that we wanted a tour of the church. Slobo said he spoke English and unsmilingly led us inside for what was a big surprise. This, the largest and most magnificent Orthodox church in the Balkans, was an empty shell. It seems that they'd been trying to finish the church for the last 80 years or so, but every time they were just about to start up, war would break out and they'd have to stop. Slobo robotically led us through the building, and then he led us out. And as we passed the vicary, he turned and strangely dropped his formality. He said, "You guys want a drink?" Sure. We sat at the table of a large room and were given tiny glasses of powerful plum brandy, Slivovitz, and Slobo looked at me and asked, "Do you play the piano?" "No, sorry. Well, I do," he said, and he walked over to the upright piano next to the table, and then he started to play. The music was both joyous and sad. And my wife and cousin started singing along with Slobo, word for word. And then he said, "Do you know this song from the mountains of Macedonia?" And they did, and they sang, and they drank, and off came Slobo's jacket. And then he said, "Do you know this old Bosnian drinking song?" And they did, and they drank, and they stood on their chairs with their arms in the air, and off came Slobo's tie. And they kept on singing and dancing and drinking and laughing. And then Slobo stopped playing. He twisted around, looked at me hard, and said, "Do you know we had the best country in the world? We had freedom and money, but we didn't have to work like dogs like you in the West. We had good lives, and we destroyed it. Do you know I am not even from Belgrade? I'm from Croatia. I was here when the war started, and I got stuck. I am from Dalmatia. Do you know this old Dalmatian fisherman's song? And he started to play. They knew the song, and they sang, and they drank until they wept. And they all wept for the country they had lost. The Croat, the Serb, and the Bosnian all wept. For they were no longer countrymen. And yet they were, at least for tonight, still bound by the memory of what was and what could have been, and by this music. They were all singing as if they were the last Yugoslavs on earth.
Zaboravi,
Let me toast as well to what I'm thankful for. Jonathan Grobert's amazing show, The State We're In, is back as a podcast distributed by WBEZ Chicago. You have to check this out. I love the show. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Anna Sussman and Mark Ristich. Now, when Snap returns, we're going to do hard labor. We're going to steal from the clergy, and we're going to eat that which should never be eaten. For real, when Snap Judgment, the gratitude special, continues, stay tuned. Okay, so I was just at the gym, and the gym's packed. Everybody trying to look good, working out, which is great, but they're not working out their most important asset, the brain. That's what Lumosity.com does. It gives you exercises for your brain based on the science of neuroplasticity. And these exercises, they're fun. They're games. Takes only a few minutes a day. You train your brain at whatever you want to get better at. You decide. Maybe you want a better memory. Maybe you want to solve problems faster. Maybe you want to lord over the Uber producer Mark Ristich. But whatever your goals are, Lumosity.com can help. Gotta try Lumosity, like 50 million other users. Sign up today. Just go to Lumosity.com, click the Start Training button to create your own program, and then start playing your first game. That's Lumosity.com, and tell them you heard it on Snap Judgment. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the gratitude special. Okay, so I had just moved to Japan. The land of the rising sun. I was going to school, everything was cool, and me and my new buddies, Chris and Ray, we decided to go for a hike in the Mystic Mountains. So we're up in the woods, tromping around, getting hot, and I'm like, who's got the snacks? Yo, I'm hungry. Where are the drinks? And everybody starts looking at everybody else real stupid. Oh, I thought that's what you were carrying. Oh, wasn't that you carrying that? And everyone's backpack is full of papers and sand and nonsense, and I'm really annoyed. Because I'm supposed to be the talker, not the snack carrier, trip planner person. And I'm like, for real? Nobody brought anything? So we got to keep trekking up the stream. No nourishment, and it's hot. And we've been going up the mountain for hours. And I'm like, look, we got to turn back around. This is horrible. I need some refreshment. And who carries economic textbooks up a mountain anyway? And then something miraculous happens. A melon. Perfectly round, delicious, pale green comes bobbing down the stream towards us. What have we here? Chris jumps in the water, fishes it out, and right as he's coming back to shore, three beautiful, crisp apples follow the melon. They're glistening in the noonday sun. Yeah! An orange. Whoa! And then, a smoked sausage. And then, three, four, five bottles of Kirin Ichiban beer. They're in the cold water, demanding we pluck them out. Get those right there. And I'm getting ready, right? It's picnic time. I clear out the space, put my little jacket down. Lunch is served, y'all. I got a bottle opener, and I hear Chris shouting, dessert, there's dessert in the water, all right. I bow my head in thanks to the universe. All that clean living finally paid off. And then I hear a gong. I hear it again. And four Shinto priests, covered in white robes, break through the forest path, followed by 15 or 20 lay people. I'm sitting there with my mouth stuffed full of smoked sausage and two halves of the melon sitting in my lap. Chris is holding a beer in each hand. Ray is handing out orange slices. And their look of friendly greeting turns to instant fury. But I know everything. There was a ceremony higher up the trail. Various items were placed in the river as an offering to the god of the mountain. The god of the mountain, not for idiot foreigners. We had done a very, very bad thing. I wiped the crumbs from my mouth and started trying to rewrap the smoked sausage. Chris and Ray, they're busy trying to place half-drank bottles of beer back into the water. The scowls are growing deeper and deeper. We place the rest of the tainted bounty gently, gently in the stream and bow deeply at the priest. Our heads almost touch the ground. And then we run back down the mountain as fast as we can. I'm thankful for everybody in that story. Ray and Chris, 20 years later, I'm going to see these same jokers for the holidays. Good fortune indeed. And good fortune often is not something that just happens. You have to make it. And Paul Kaufman, he made his own good fortune right when things were at their most bleak.
When I was young, my granddad was a song leader in the church, and his twin brother was the preacher. And it was this little small Church of Christ in East Texas. He taught me how to sing harmony when I was about six. Me and my two sisters were put in a bathtub. He would hum a note into your ear, and he taught us how to really listen. I became a good singer at a young age. You know, I sang in the church a lot. Super conservative Church of Christ. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, three times a week thing. The rules of the Church of Christ. You don't sing with an instrument. Our voice is a voice that was given to us by God, and God only is kind of the thing. And I love to go in community and sing with 400 people all a cappella in a room. That's freaking awesome. This old lady who sang that he had a booming like opera soprano voice, and like my granddad would give her a little nod from the stage and she'd just be killing it. My granddad was, you know, when he was diagnosed with cancer, well, I was 10 years old and he didn't have long to live, and he died about 2 months later, so it was real fast. It was terrible, you know. I had to grow up really fast, because right after that, I mean, my parents got a divorce, and it was me and my two sisters and my mother, and we were real broke. I would say that I chose more of a rough path due to having to grow up so soon at a young age. Once I learned how to really drink beer and whiskey, I really did it with a meaning, so, and smoking pot and everything else, everything under the sun. Well, what happened is I got caught with weed, got put on probation, partied, and got caught with some drug charges. They gave me the sentence that I'm going to have to do 6 months. My mom was freaking the hell out right before I went in there, you know, and she was like, don't be scared, and she's crying. I was like, how am I supposed to not be scared when you're crying? And they handcuffed me and put me in jail. Buttoned up and taken to the pumpkin patch out on Highway 69, wearing my orange jumpsuit onesie, you know. There's three tanks that could hold probably about 15 to 25 people in each tank. First tank I look in is all white people. Second tank, all Mexican and Asian. Third tank, all black people. And so I was like, wow, what in the hell have I stepped into? Now I'm seeing real life segregation and all this stuff going on, you know? So there's only room in the African-American tank. I mean, they're bringing me in real late. These guys all wake up at 4:30 in the morning to go out to work. So the most annoying thing is when somebody's coming into their bunk and having just waking everybody up, you know? I go to the very back corner and they said, okay, take that. And the officer shines the light into that top bunk in that corner. And I walk over there, and I'm a big guy, so it's tough for me to just hop on a top bunk. So I used the foot of the bottom bunk, which was this guy, Tony, this guy with a gold grill. And that guy said, hey, boy, that'll be the last time you step on my bed. And I was like, oh, right, I'm sorry, sir.
And I get no sleep that night.
I was just kind of paranoid more than anything. You could possibly be killed or shanked or hurt or beat up or raped or whatever goes through anybody's head in jail.
You know, yeah, those things can eat you up. Or you can be like, you got to be cool. You got to not piss off anybody. Can't get too close to anybody. I mean, if all else failed, you know, I was going to keep to myself. Started going out of the County Road and Bridge Department that next morning. It's chain gang work where you're hooked up and you go out in vans and go fix the county roads and bridges around East Texas. When you're moved from the jail and transport, you're chained to the next person next to you. And then when you go out, there's guys with guns. Breaking rocks down, singing, all on the highway. They went like that. You know, it's not, oh, brother, where art thou? But close, you know. I'd walk behind an asphalt truck, pick out the rocks, big rocks out of the black tar. It's real hot as hell, you know. It was me, old school, Reverend Al, Tony, Castaneda. Never forget this guy. In and out of jail for 9 years. Got out 4 different times, never got out for more than 3 days. Well, he said, man, I haven't had a burger in like 7 years, man. And I was like, yeah, well, tomorrow I'll try to figure out how we do this. No way, man. How are you going to get it past Sarge? And I was like, dude, I'll figure out a way. I'd find out where we're going the next day. I called my dad and I called my mom. I was like, okay, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., you need to drop off a bunch of Whataburger cheeseburgers and a bunch of fries over here because I'm going to feed the whole crew. And I told my sergeant, I know that you're going to have to go all the way back to the other side of town on Highway 69 and I-20 to get some food and bring us back bologna sandwiches. Or you can let these bags of cheeseburgers that I just had my mom and dad drop off behind that building right there, and you can look at those and you can have one yourself. There's a bacon cheeseburger in there with your name on it. And he said, all right. All these guys haven't had real food in years. It was like eating a burger for the first time. It felt like that time on that movie Shawshank Redemption on that roof when they're tarring the roof and all those guys get to drink those beers. I was like, oh my God, I feel like Andy Dufresne. We didn't eat all the burgers because, I mean, our stomachs haven't been eating real food. And when you just start grubbing on something greasy, you know, it's just like, oh, your stomach. So we tried to smuggle the burgers back in into the jail. We're walking in and we each have 2 burgers in our little onesie, and they pat us down and they find all these burgers and they say, all right, we're giving you 10 minutes to eat all that. And so we sat there and we were still full, but we just said this is for the guys inside. So Tony, later, he said, so tell me why you're in here and, you know, ask me all these questions. That kind of made it to where, okay, I'm sorry for stepping on your bed. Now we're friends. Let's smoke cigarettes and shoot the shit. Well, we started singing gospel songs. Well, we start freaking get the pins, you know. Do that kind of stuff, you know, and we'd get styrofoam cups and cut out the bottom of the cup and make our own little microphone, you know.
1, 2. Ooh, way, I got you.
We'd all sing this 3-part harmony, old hymns that my granddad taught me.
Well, I'm so tired and so weary, but I must go home till the Lord.
By about the 4th or 5th Sunday, it was standing room only in that cell.
There will be peace in the valley for me someday.
When you can, for some reason, music and singing with somebody brings you close, you know, and you feel, you get a warm sensation over you. You feel good. The people that don't talk much or kind of keep to themselves, for some reason that Sunday they'd come out and you'd hear them singing, or they'd have something to say or something to offer to talk about. Not talk about the Bible or anything. They'd talk about life, you know, and that was one thing. It was probably one of the best churches I'd been to. Shoot. I do remember one time when we did sing Peace in the Valley. Our buddy Reverend Al is what we called him. And he kind of choked up a little bit because, you know, one of the songs was sang in his grandmother's funeral or something. And then he talked about that. It was just real talk. All of a sudden,
it was me and 5 black guys that became my best friends. We hug like kin. We're
family. We have a bond that's beyond, you know. We've been at the lowest point of our lives together.
Singing together with some folks in jail brought joy and brought some light at the end of the tunnel for me, because I knew what I had to do when I got out. And I guess the recognition of being able to just put together a little singing group in the jailhouse kind of let me realize I can put together a group anywhere.
Story made me want to go and have a cheeseburger. You know, just because I can. Much love to Paul Kaufman and everyone still on the inside. Paul now heads the band Sons of Fathers. We'll have a link and a bonus track on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Stephanie Fu. Now, maybe all this food talk is making you hungry. Maybe you think you're starting to feel famished. Well, think again. When Snap Judgment, the Gratitude Special continues, stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Snap Judgment. Now, there are lots of other NPR podcasts that include great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes or wherever fantastic stuff is packaged and given away for free. Back to Snap Judgment, the Gratitude Special from PRX and NPR. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, we're diving into that which we are grateful for. And Snappers, frankly, I didn't know just how grateful, how thankful I was until I heard this next story from the land down under.
Traveling across Australia on my way to a place called Port Macdonald, which is in the top end of Australia. There's not a lot of people out there. There's small communities scattered throughout that part of the territory. It's very dry, pretty harsh, scrubby sort of land. There's not a lot out there. Kangaroos, a few bugs, wild dogs. I always listen to music. I was listening to Red Hot Chili Peppers. This was the third time I'd actually gone around Australia, so I knew the area, I knew the roads, and I wasn't that worried to be driving out there on my own because I'd done it before. I don't know, if you might hear a lot of stories about Australia and people going missing in the outback, and yeah, I used to make fun of those people. You know, you don't think that anything like that could happen to you. I saw some people, looked like they were broken down on the side of the road, and this is what they led me to believe anyway. I ended up stopping to help them, and I let one of them in my car. About half an hour or 40 minutes down the road, this guy somehow managed to slip something into a can of Pepsi that I had beside me. I started feeling drowsy, and the next thing I know, this guy was wrestling me for the steering wheel, and yeah, we sort of ended up having a little bit of a fighting match in the car, and then ended up getting stuck down the bottom of a ravine. Then I passed out. I remember waking up. It was dark when I woke up, and I could smell the earth. I could hear this noise coming from behind me. And as I stood up, big flash of daylight hit me in the eyes, and I realised that I was sort of in a hole, and I'd been covered up with a piece of tarpaulin. I looked up, and a few dingoes sort of standing around. It looked like one of them was actually scratching at the tarpaulin, trying to get under it. So that's what sort of woke me up, I think. Picked up a couple of rocks and threw them at the dingoes, and they all took a few steps back, and you know, I was still a bit dazed and confused, and I sort of tried to work out where I was. I realised I had no shoes and no socks, and I was basically left in a pair of shorts and a t-shirt, and they'd taken everything else from me. I ended up walking most of that day. Never thought I'd actually be out there for any length of time, so I just sort of kept walking, thinking that any minute now I'm going to walk over a sort of a horizon or the next batch of trees and find a road and go and find my car, and everything was going to be okay. The first 2 days I was out there, I didn't have any water at all, so I had to urinate in my jocks and then wring it out in my mouth to get some sort of fluid, which was pretty disgusting. If you ever have to do it, make sure you let it cool down first, because yeah, it's not very nice. But then on the third day, after praying for water, I saw a massive thunderstorm off in the distance, so I sort of ran towards that, managed to find a heap of water. I didn't see any more water for about 8 days after that, but what I did was, the t-shirt that I was wearing, I took that off and I used to drag that through the grass in the morning, that sort of, you know, soak up all the dew, and I'd get a little bit of water every morning that way. But I didn't really see any decent water for, I don't know, a good 10 to 12 day period. I was getting pretty hungry because I hadn't eaten anything yet. I was looking for some witchetty grubs inside a couple of old dead tree trunks. I stuck my hand down inside one of them and I got bitten by a big bush centipede, which basically started to paralyze my body after about 4 or 5 hours. I ended up about 3.5, 4 hours later, sort of staggering around, screaming out, trying to get help from someone. But obviously there was nobody out there, and then the last thing I know, I passed out. It got to the point where, because I wasn't eating any food, I mean, apart from sort of lizards that I could catch, small lizards, crickets, grasshoppers, a few bugs, over the sort of 10, 12 day period that I was walking out there, I started losing weight and I just started losing energy. I ended up finding the dam and I camped on that dam for about 10 days, drank a heap of water, started eating leeches and frogs and things like that. And then one day I decided that, yep, feel pretty good again. I've got some food, got some water. So I tried to start walking again. I walked about maybe 4 or 5 k's away from the dam and ended up dropping from dehydration again. I woke up in the sun, sort of roasting away, and I just thought, there's no way I can walk anymore. So I literally turned around and started walking back towards the dam, and it took me about 6 hours to walk 5 kilometers back to the dam. So yeah, I just realized that I didn't have the energy to walk away from there. I was stuck there, I wasn't going anywhere. I thought, if nobody comes to find me, then there's a good chance that I won't walk out of here. Yeah, it was a bit of a worry. Well, first there was the dingoes. I mean, if anybody knows anything about Australia, dingoes can be pretty vicious. They hunt in packs and they sort of prey on anything that's weak, and they must have realised that I was in a bit of trouble. This one pack of dingoes literally followed me the whole way and hung around the little camp that I made. They basically stayed there the whole time, more or less waiting for me to die, I think. Because I'd been eating different types of vegetation, I was actually stripping plants with my teeth. I think I got some splinters or something under one of my teeth and ended up turning into an abscess. And one morning I woke up and I thought I'd been bitten by a spider because the whole side of my mouth was swollen up, and I was really worried. I actually thought, yeah, this is it, I'm going to die. So I sort of laid there for the next sort of 6 to 8 hours waiting to die, but I didn't. I just laid there in pain. I broke a bit of wire off the fence and I ended up stabbing the blisters inside my mouth with this bit of wire, and then I just ended up spitting all the bad blood out. The blisters just kept coming up, even though I kept popping them, they kept pumping up, and the tooth was getting loose, and I just realized that the tooth had to come out. So I ended up getting this really big thick piece of fencing wire and ended up hooking it underneath my tooth. I had 2 or 3 goes at it. The first go I had it, I passed out, and then I woke up and I was sort of in a pool of blood coming out of my mouth, and then got up the courage and had another go at it. The second time I didn't pass out, but it was, yeah, I was in a lot of pain. And then the third go I had at it, I actually pulled it out. But as I pulled it out, I passed out from pain again. And I woke up and I had this tooth hanging out my mouth. What freaked me out the most was watching myself just get thinner and thinner every day. Even though I was trying to eat as much as I could, the dam that I was staying on, I ended up eating all the frogs, all the leeches. I ate all the crickets, all the grasshoppers. I just slowly watched myself, getting thinner and thinner and thinner. I remember sitting there one day just thinking to myself, how thin does a person get before they actually die? Every day I woke up, I saw a new bone poking out somewhere. The dam was getting dry. It was at that point where I was just waiting to die. It was just a matter of time. Think about your family, think about your friends, think about all the things you wish you'd done. I wanted to do a lot more traveling overseas. Hadn't had kids yet. I put a cross above the shelter that I made out there. I thought eventually, surely someone might come across this dam, and if they do, if the dingoes haven't come and taken my body away, that there'll be some remains left inside and my family might have something to bury. I wrote a little message in the side of my cattle trough that I made my home. I just wrote my name up in there and my date of birth and things like that. So I thought if they do find me, then somebody will know whose bones were there anyway. Every night I sort of entombed myself just in case I didn't wake up the next day. When I first started putting the shelter together, I'd be sitting in it sometimes and the wind would whistle through there and it used to sound like a car driving down the road, and I'd jump out to see if it was, and of course it never was, until this one day I was laying in the shelter. I heard this noise and it sounded like a car, and it's like boy cry wolf, whatever, it's not really happening. And all of a sudden I heard it change gears and I thought, no, that's not the wind doesn't change gears. I quickly jumped out of my shelter. The guys that were in the car, they thought that I was a dingo up on top of the dam, so they pulled the gun out, looked through the scope of the gun and saw that it was a human up on top of the dam and not a dingo. And then they sort of came over and said, are you all right? And started asking me questions, who I was, where I was, what the hell I was doing out there. And I started to go through the whole story, and they couldn't believe it. Couldn't stop touching them just to make sure they were real. I was actually out there for 71 days in total before I actually got found, so not quite 3 months. But then they took me back to their station house, called the flying doctor service, and then the flying doctor service came in the next day and picked me up. I was in the hospital for about 5 or 6 weeks before I signed myself out. I was so happy about being back in the land of the living that I didn't want to sit in hospital. When I actually had to walk into a shopping centre and it was filled with hundreds of people, and I was trying to get my head around actually dodging people and dodging trolleys and having to talk to people, it was a little bit daunting, a bit overwhelming. It sort of scared me a bit. Then I'd be going to lock myself in my house for 2 or 3 days. When I got back, a lot of people didn't believe that I'd been out there for any length of time. That was what was the worst part about it, that I'd actually spent all that time out there, nearly died, hadn't done anything wrong, and was being made to feel like that I lied about the whole thing, And it's like, well, I'm not here to tell you that I'm telling the truth. I'm happy just that I'm actually alive and I'm happy to be here. 4 months later, 5 months later, I went back out there. And I just felt like, a big part of my life had changed, and I needed a bit of closure. I just felt like I left a part of me out there. So we went out there and we nearly got stuck out there again, myself and the reporter that I went out with. We got our car stuck in the mud. We ended up camping out in the same hut that I hated for so long. I just thought, oh no, here we go again. It's all happening all over again. But luckily, we'd already told the station where we were, and when we didn't turn up, they sent the chopper out to have a look for us, and the same station guys that sort of rescued me the first time came back out and rescued the both of us the second time. It was a bit of a laughing matter, actually. They thought it was a great joke. I was having nightmares, honey. I literally couldn't sleep that night. I was having nightmares. It was unbelievable. Everyone was quite relieved to hear that chopper land, I tell you.
Now then, I am extremely, gloriously thankful that I am not Ricky McGee eating leeches and lizards. Leave the Outback alone, man. It's not for you. Stay close to town. But big thanks to Ricky for sharing your story with the Snap. It was lovingly produced by our own Anna Sussman. It is that time. But don't worry, Snap Nation. Full episodes, movies, pictures, stuff available right now for your pleasure at snapjudgment.org. Facebook, yes. Twitter, we've got that. Snap was produced by myself and the Snap Super Magical Squad. I am so grateful for each and every one. Please give it up for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti Miller beats the beats. Anna Sussman knows these streets. Stephanie Fu can't be beats. Can't outwit Julia DeWitt. Can't steal a coat from Nick Vanderkolk. Who writes this stuff? Can't steal a coat from Nick Vanderkolk. Better hurry, yo, if you're gonna catch Renzo Gorio. I'll be here all day, folks. All day. He's never Mina. Snap's own Will Urbina. I know. They thought they could just sneak into your holiday party without anybody noticing. Even though only three other people were going to be there. And they were all your great aunts. Don't throw them out, though. It's just the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Hoping for a drumstick, maybe a little gravy. Much love to the CPB. Thanks to WBEZ in Chicago. Even though it's cold and windy outside, they're warm and toasty on the inside. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, exchanges all of your holiday gifts for public radio equipment, like sound dampening curtains and audio editing software. Sexy. Doesn't seem like a very fair trade, but that's the way it is. PRX.org. And as you may have discovered, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could get all excited. Go home for the holidays, have visions of cornbread and mama's mashed potatoes dancing in your head, and because of some mix-up at the airport, you end up at Ricky McGee's place in the Outback. The only thing on the holiday menu is frogs and leeches. And he ate all the frogs. Even then, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.